This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2018, held at Faith Builders on July 31 to August 3.
Thank you, Gerald, for sharing with us, moving our hearts toward worship as we were singing about our love for the Lord. I was thinking about God's love for us and just recognizing that always when we express our love for Him, it's a response love. His love to us is so much greater, purer, richer, fuller. In this last session, I want to look at rising to the challenge. And for me, this is actually more challenging because I always find it easier to describe problems than to talk about solutions. We are living in bad times. When you mix the love of pleasure with wealth, and incidentally, I noted yesterday that Apple assets passed $1 trillion, first time a public company has reached that mark. But we're living in bad times. You mix the love of pleasure with wealth, and you add all the technology that we have. Human beings, I think, have never had so many varied opportunities to pursue evil. A number of years ago, I was working with a couple. They had three children. The oldest was 3 years old. They were making good money. Their favorite way to spend their money was to go to the bars in the evening and dance. But their marriage was in trouble. They actually were in the process of a divorce. The wife was promiscuous. She would sometimes spend days away from home with other men. They actually didn't know who their youngest child's father was until the baby was born. When they left in the evening to go to the bars, they would leave their children with a babysitter. And the babysitter's job consisted primarily of turning on the television. As I interacted with them over the course of several months in their home and elsewhere, I think one of the saddest things for me was to watch the three-year-old. This three-year-old girl knew how to flirt. I don't think she actually knew what she was doing, but she knew the moves and the language. One of the effects of technology today that I grieve probably over more than anything else is the way it exposes children regularly to adult sin. Betrayal, adultery, and all sorts of deviant sexual sins, drunkenness, witchcraft, lying, mugging, all the sins of human debauchery are portrayed as entertainment, and children get exposed to it. We are living in bad times. But against this tide of wickedness, we need to rise to the challenge. We must not lose hope. Thomas More said, "The times are never so bad that a good man cannot live in them." In his book, Making Choices, Peter Kraft talks about bad times, and he says a number of hopeful things. He says, "Bad times are no excuse for bad choices and bad lives." He says, actually, bad times are a veil of soul making. And the good souls that are made in that dark valley heal the world and bring light into the valley. And I think as we are willing to engage with people who are living in darkness, we come to appreciate the light of Jesus. Bad times, he says, are for good people, and good people for bad times. So we must not lose hope. I'd like to consider a number of strategies in a moment, a little later here, but I want to think about some of the tensions that we live in order to understand how to respond, how to rise to the challenge that faces us. And I'd like to think about these challenges, reflecting on the words of Jesus in his prayer the night before he gave his life. John 17, I will read a number of verses in addition to the one I've projected here. He says to the Father, I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. And then verse 15, I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them by your truth. Your word is truth. As you have sent me into the world, I also have sent them into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself, that they also may be sanctified by the truth. Jesus here praying for his followers. And the tension, the first tension we note here in this prayer of Jesus is that we are in this world. He prays not that the Father would take us out, but that he would keep us from the evil one. We are in, but we are not of this world. It's a tension that we have lived with from the dawn of Christianity. We know that the gospel is timeless. This is a message that every generation needs to hear, needs to experience, but it is lived out in different contexts. The world we are in sometimes changes with where we are in the world, different cultures, different situations. And so we have to ask ourselves, what does it mean to follow Jesus in 21st century America or Canada or wherever we are living? Would Jesus use PowerPoint? I hope so. Would he have a smartphone? We have to ask ourselves, and if he would, how would he use it? There's another tension that we have that we have to think about. This isn't found specifically in Jesus' prayer, but we are conservatives. We name ourselves that. We're conservatives, and we're in a changing world that creates tension for us. How do we think about conserving? How do we think about change? For a number of years, I've been saying that conservative Christians in our time really need to think about and talk about and understand change. The reality is that even with our resistance to change, we change. I have many friends among the Amish culture, and I've been told on numerous occasions by these that in spite of their resistance to change, the Amish also are changing. And I think we all know that if we simply let change happen by default, it's rarely wise. We have to think about these things. And this subject of how to handle change is larger than I can handle here, and it's not my focus, but I'm recognizing that it's a tension that faces us. Some things we know do not change. Forever, O Lord, thy word is settled in heaven. Psalm 119. The Lord said through the prophet Malachi, for I am the Lord, I change not. We can anchor our souls on that. God does not change. God's word does not change. Basic Christian doctrine does not change. We call it orthodoxy. But other things do change. Other things actually must change. We all with open face, beholding as in a glass, as in a mirror, the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image. We have to change. We need to change. But then Paul gives a rather puzzling statement to, at least for us, to the Corinthians. He says, "For though I am free from all men, I have made myself servant to all, that I might win the more. And to the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as without law." Wonder what that looked like. And he clarifies, not being without law toward God, but under law toward Christ, that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became as weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that by all means I might save some. If we understand this, Paul was apparently conducting himself in different ways in different settings. Was he hypocritical? I do want to point here that there was a constant in those different situations. The constant was his life goal in each of these circumstances, each of these situations, to glorify God by proclaiming Jesus to all people. He was apparently willing to change in some surface ways in order to be effective where it counted. So, people change, cultures change, situations change. How do we change appropriately within the context, the particular context we find ourselves, without changing fundamentally? It's a tension. A third tension that we have to think about is a tension between where we focus when it comes to our response to the world, living in the world. We are living in this world, this fast-changing world, and I like to suggest that our response needs to be two-pronged, and in some ways it creates for us a bit of a tension, but first of all, the focus on doing what is good and right, and then also turning from what is debilitating, what is wrong, what is harmful. And I would suggest that we need to also keep these two. Part of the difficulty is keeping these two in right tension with each other. Our focus must always be more on doing good than on avoiding. That has to be the greater emphasis. It's why I have attempted in these talks to say the greatest commandment is to love God with all our heart, to love our neighbor as ourselves. So we have to think about these tensions as we look at strategies. Now, I'd like to consider with you five strategies this morning, five strategies for iChristians, and I am using the term iChristians, recognizing that Christians in our times, we are benefiting, and we are benefiting from, and we are using technology. And in that sense, we have become iChristians. That is, we have become impacted by technology. Now, when Steve Jobs first introduced the iMac, that was back in 1998, he said the I stood for, you know what? The internet. That's what the I stood for. But he went on to say that's not all it stands for. Okay, here is a device now that connects us to the internet. It's the iMac. But he said it also stands for the individual. It also stands for inform and for inspire. So he had a number of I words there. Experientially, it seems as though the I has come perhaps to be about me, about the I personal. And as such, if we think about the I Christian, in other words, as a self-focused person, then that's a tragic contradiction, because our Christian means to love God and to love others. So if we're I Christians, we're in trouble. But I'm using the term here with an assumption that even though we may not all here have iPhones or iPads or whatever, we are living in the age of technology. What are strategies? How can we address? How can we live well in this time? I've already emphasized the first strategy, but I want to bring it back into focus. We need to set our hearts right in alignment with the two greatest commandments, setting our hearts to worship God, to love Him, to know Him in increasing measure. I urge you, keep it in focus. Nurture that love in a regular way. We will not drift into deep relationship with God. Read the scriptures. Open your heart in regular ways to God. Read good authors. I think that one of the ways that God shapes us and we nurture our love for God is by fellowship with other believers whose hearts are turned toward God. And we do that both in presence with God's people and also by reading, by interacting through reading others who have sought the Lord. I will tell you, probably the person apart from my family and church who shaped my life, the person, the author that shaped me initially toward God was A.W. Tozer. I read his Knowledge of the Holy as a young man, and it moved my heart. I wanted to know this God. Other authors, Andrew Murray, G. Campbell Morgan, C.S. Lewis, George MacDonald, I could name many. I've done a lot of reading, but I like to read the authors that move my heart toward God, that help me to see who He is. I want to say, insert here, that I'm not saying that all our reading has to be exclusively Christian authors. I read non-Christian authors at times, and I think there are ways in which that can help us to understand the time, help us to understand the people that we interact with. I've read naturalist writers. I remember reading Thomas Hardy, some of his books, Stephen Crane, and some of these naturalistic and even nihilistic authors, and it helps me to understand the times. It helps me to understand the emptiness, the ways, what happens in people's lives, and understanding and philosophy when they deny the supernatural. In setting our hearts right, of course, we need to consider also the second command. Gerald has helped us to think about that. Set your heart to love those around you. Live the other's ethic. I actually think that if we could live these commands, it would guide us in very practical ways for how to use electronic gadgetry. I actually think that it would cause us to sometimes not check text in certain settings. We would put our phones away in certain times just because we love God and we love people. I think about this maybe, I don't know if you want to do this or not, but I wonder what would come out of a discussion even with high school students when you think about what love for others, how it would affect our use of electronic gadgets. If you would take a group of high school students and study 1 Corinthians 13 and ask them to come up with some guidance for how that would inform cell phone use, the use of cell phones. How would 1 Corinthians 13 guide them in interacting on social media? So, if we're going to rise to the challenge, setting our hearts right. Second strategy, engage in the kingdom. Paul's guidance to the Christians at Rome, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. I said our approach here needs to be two-pronged. There's this tension between doing good and avoiding. But I want you to notice here how Paul focuses on on giving our lives, entering into the work of God, the call of God on our lives. If we're going to engage in the kingdom, we need to know what our calling is. What calling? You understand? Just a simple question. What does God want you to do with your life? Are you a teacher? Are you a teacher because this is the will of God for you? Know your calling. Be convinced that you are doing with your life, with your resources, with your abilities, what God wants you to do. When the Apostle Paul was struck down there on the road to Damascus, "Who are you, Lord? What will you have me to do?" It's a question that he asked. And maybe he just meant right now, like, do I need to get up? Do I need to fall down? Do I need to die? What should I do? But it was a question that God answered with his calling. I want you to get up. He gave some instructions, go, but I am sending you. By the way, I guess there he said, it will be told what you should do. And then when Ananias came to him, he was told, your mission, your life calling is to bring Jesus to the Gentiles. Know your calling, live your calling. Ask God, what do you want from my life? I think it's good to just very practically, we can practice dedication experiences. One author says that one of the things that we can do actually to help us have a sense of doing the will of God with what he has given me, just lie on your back with your arms outstretched on the floor in a private setting and dedicate your body to the Lord. Just give him your body, your life. You can name your hands, your feet, your tongue, but give your body to God. I beseech you, present your bodies a living sacrifice, your vehicle. If you've got a vehicle, what about just dedicating it to the Lord, just giving it to the Lord? You know, this hit me years ago. I had a vehicle that was heading very rapidly toward the earth and had to get another one. And then I realized, you know, I get this other one and that's kind of neat, but vehicles really head fast. I'm old enough that I can tell you folks, they go back to the dust and they go rapidly. Sometimes we help them along too quickly, but that's the direction they're headed. And then it hit me. Look, if they're headed that way anyway, why not give this to God and wear it out for him? Okay. Like use it. Look for the opportunities to use a vehicle. Just, you know, get it into the dust quick through use for the kingdom of God. Otto Koning, I remember then later I heard him and he talked about dedicating his vehicles. He said this, I don't know if his motive was really good, but he said, when you give things to God, then it's God's job to take care of it, you know. And so he heard his son taking his new vehicle out the driveway and he was peeling. And Otto Koning quickly went and said, Lord, I'm going to give this thing to you. He wanted God to take care of it. But anyway, better motivation maybe is, Lord, how can we give this to you? How can we use this for you? Electronic media. Would it be okay to have dedication ceremonies for our media? Gadgets, smartphones, tablets. Lord, this is yours. How do you want me to use it? And I use my computer for the glory of God. Your hobbies, your recreation, your entertainment. As I said earlier in another session, there certainly is a place, I think, for us to do what is relaxing, what is disengaging, what is rejuvenating. But we always have to ask ourselves, is what I'm doing detracting me, distracting me, taking me away from my responsibilities, or is it preparing me to engage them well? Engaging in the kingdom, in Gerald's words, picking up the towel. A third strategy, if we're going to rise to the challenge of using electronic media, electronic gadgets properly, assess your habits. This is tough. Remember the fish swimming. We hardly can sometimes even recognize what all is going on, and particularly the effects of the things around us. But in our changing world, I think it's necessary for us to take the time to develop strategies of assessment, trying to understand ourselves individually as well as collectively. I think this needs to be an individual thing and also needs to be something we do as groups. You know, the scriptures do this repeatedly, urge us in this repeatedly. Examine your ways, but let a man examine himself. Take heed to yourself. Consider yourself, lest you also be tempted. He who has an ear, let him hear. The scripture is constantly calling us to think about ourselves, our lives. Where are we? How did we get here? Where are we now in relation to where we want to be? In relation to where we should be? Assessing our practices, the things that we do. Do our practices actually align with our values? Does my life, if somebody watches my life, would they conclude this person loves God? I can tell by the way they spend their time. I can tell by the way they think. I can tell by the things they talk about. I can tell by the way they sacrifice, the things they give up. This person is dedicated to, loves God above everything else. This person is a loving person. Our habits. To save us time here today, I gave you a sheet with some assessment tools. And I am not going to go over all of these, but you'll notice the quote from Susanna Wesley. I understand that when her son John was heading off to college, this is what his mother said to him. Whatever weakens your reason, impairs the tenderness of your conscience, obscures your sense of God, or takes off your relish for spiritual things, in short, whatever increases the strength and authority of your body over your mind, that thing is sin to you, however innocent it may be in itself. In a recent two-part article in the KMF Messenger, Kyle Stolzfus talked about technology, and he used Susan's words to her son, Susanna's words to her son, and just took each of those and helped us think about that. I recommend, I'm not going to read the articles, but the first article was entitled, I think, Distracting to Death, and this one, Discerning Black and White in an HD World. Just encourage, those are good articles to read. The Apostle Paul actually gave some advice to the Corinthians about their use of smartphones. And I quote here, all things are lawful for me, but all things are not helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. A little later in the same letter, he says, again, all things are lawful for me. Just insert here that commentators actually think perhaps this was a saying that they used and maybe misused as Christians. All things are lawful for me. And he helps us think about that. Not all that is lawful is helpful. So again, the chapter 10 here, verses 23, 24, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not all things edify. Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. Guidance. And so I'd like to break this down and just raise a number of assessment questions when we think of, and apply this to electronic gadgets and so on. Is it helpful? We have to ask that question. I want to point out here that when Paul asks these questions or gives these assessment tools for us, you'll notice that he recognizes that we don't make all our decisions along the lines of right and wrong. If we just ask the question, is it right or wrong, it's like a one-dimensional assessment. And that's not always very good. Another one-dimensional assessment would be, is it useful or is it efficient? Not all things that are efficient are always helpful. Let me give you my little favorite one here, or pet peeve, or whatever you may want to call it. I do not like calling a company or organization and getting an answering machine. Is it efficient? I suppose it saves people lots of money. But I don't like listening to an answering machine. If you want this, press 1. If you want that, press 2, and so on. That I do not like is actually a euphemism for how I really feel. Okay. What if heaven would use an answering machine? You know, if you're anxious, press 1 immediately. If you have OCD, press 2 repeatedly. If you're depressed, don't matter. It doesn't matter. Or if you're paranoid, we've got your number and we know where you are. What if heaven had an answering machine that had us pressing buttons? We want people. It is so refreshing when you call and you say, I'd like to talk to a real human being. I've got a question that this thing doesn't answer and I don't know which button to push. Well, sorry, how did I get on that? Is it helpful? One dimensional. We can ask sometimes, is it efficient? Is it helpful? I use PowerPoint. I use some of these kinds of things because I find it's one of the ways for an audience to follow along. But I will insert here that there are times when I intentionally don't. Okay? So I'll maybe come back to that a bit later. Is it helpful? Does it edify? Sorry, trying to find my place here. You know, I don't know. Is it helpful? Does it edify? These are questions that kind of go together. But I'd also say that with these, even using these things, we have to be careful. You know, if I bounce each point in here from Seattle, Washington, and it lands on my screen, it's actually likely going to be more distracting than helpful or edifying. And while I'm trying to make a point, people are wondering, how did he do that? I wonder if I could do that on mine. And you hear how these things can actually be distracting instead of helpful. What is the effect on others? How does it affect others when I check my email during a meeting? How does it affect my friends when I check a text during a conversation? How does it affect my friends, the things that I post on Facebook? Another question, evaluative question from the Apostle Paul, does it glorify God? If even our eating and our drinking is to be for the glory of God, certainly our use of phones or tablets or computers should. Does it control me? Paul's language, I will not be brought under the power. We hear a lot about addictions today. I talked about it yesterday. Media addictions, but assessing, helping us to think about, does it control me? And in line with that, another assessment tool that I put on your sheet, 10 signs of substance addiction. These are signs of substance addictions that people who work with substance abuse people, they use this in order to determine, is this person addicted? And one of the reasons, I want to insert here, that one of the reasons that we have to do that is because people will be addicted to substances and deny it. They will in their minds have it, well, I'm in control here. I'm not addicted. I'm not, because they look maybe at somebody else who's worse. So I'm actually not addicted. These signs have been, you can find these in a variety of settings. It's not like I don't think it's a copyrighted thing, but they've listed the signs of substance addiction. I took those signs and just raised some questions for help us to think about our media. So craving is the first sign of substance addiction. Applying it to media, do you constantly have the urge to check your phone? The craving. Neglecting responsibilities is a sign of substance addiction. So does it distract you from your responsibilities? Does it cause irritation when you're asked to lay it down? Drug seeking is one of the signs of substance abuse. People go back to it, they seek it, they look for ways to get it. So does applying it to me, to cell phones and whatever, does your mind constantly go to when you can return to whatever it was, your game, your social media? Physical dependence, fourth sign. Do you find yourself tuned out to conversations and interactions? That is, so dependent upon this, and so I have to go back to it, and I can't actually engage with conversations. Unhealthy relationships. People who are on drugs will form friendships with other people where they can either do it together or get it. How has your use of technology dictated who you bond with? Isolation, sign of substance abuse. Has your use of technology alienated you from family or church? Poor money management. I think you have those. I'm going to just keep going here. Fourth tactic. You can read over those later. By the way, there's another assessment there that was, this one was a list of 25 questions, I think it was, that our pastor recently, we got together as a group, and he gave us this little survey, and we had to answer yes or no, and then we got in small groups. Actually, I wasn't there. I was gone on some meetings, but the rest of the group, we got into small groups and talked about, and you added up how many yeses you had, and then you got in small groups and talked about your reflections on this. Interestingly, this is one of the things that came out of this. Some of the older people had the higher scores. We often think this is for young people. Anyway, I'm not going to go there. I want to insert one more thing here. Here's an assessment thing that you can do. Close friend of yours. Take a close friend, somebody who's going to be honest with you, and ask them, when you look at you observe my use of technology, do you have any concerns? Are there any ways in which I use technology that irritate you? Okay, just use a friend. That's one of the ways to assess. Let's go to a fourth strategy, developing resistance tactics around specific traps. I'm going to just give illustrations here. I don't have time to expand on these a lot, but sales resistance, just a policy, a personal policy, like saying, I won't buy a gadget the first time I see it. I'm going to resist that urge. I'm going to put it off and then give myself some time. One of my cousins, friends, he's a preacher, he said that one of the things he does for sales resistance is that he makes a list. When he goes into a store, he has a list, and he will not buy anything that is not on his list. Sales resistance. Now, he did admit, he said, there have been a couple of times when I saw a really good deal, and I went back out in my vehicle, and I wrote it on my list, and then I went back in and bought it. Sales resistance. Time management. Looking at setting limits. This is one that I've used sometimes when I noticed that I was checking news too repeatedly, and I just, I'll check news once a day. Just a way to resist a resistance tactic. Gadget fasting. Can you do without it? Just put it away for a time. Try to do without it for a specific time. So one of the reasons that I sometimes teach or preach without using PowerPoint, without using, is just because I want to do it without. Jesus didn't use PowerPoint. Okay, so he was an excellent teacher. And it also is one of the ways to help so that my audience doesn't get just dependent upon it. Can we still listen? Cut it off. Sometimes we need to use radical means. And I just want to say this. If electronic gadgetry is getting you into sin, then cut it off. Use the strong approach, just saying, I will not do this. Remember the story I told you, the minister put away his, sold all his fishing equipment and guns and so on. It was something that had taken priority in his life. There are some of us who it's better for us just not to have certain things if it's a way that is destroying our lives. We can have school policies. It's one of the ways to develop resistance tactics. So no cell phone use at school. It's a common thing in many schools. We may have group or family agreements, like we will just not use cell phones. Some groups just take that position. And it's a way to develop resistance, just recognizing some of these things may be too dangerous for us, and recognizing our need to cut off or hate what detracts from loving God, loving others, fulfilling our calling. And a fifth tactic, practice presence in your relationships. I can again here only illustrate, but practicing presence. One of the concerns, and I alluded to it when we talked about traps earlier here, but one of the concerns about electronic gadgetry is that it is actually taking us away from personal relationships. Instead of engaging with one another, we're distracted. Just a few suggestions here. Practice active listening. And I want to insert here, if you're teachers, okay? Do you know what teachers do? Teachers do a lot of talking. Preachers do a lot of talking. Unfortunately, I'm both a teacher and a preacher. And you know what? Especially teachers, we're constantly talking to people who don't know as much as we do. One of the dangers is that we quit listening. Some years ago, I came to realize this, and I realized that God sometimes wants to talk to me through people who know less than I do. But I've got to be a listener. If you don't know, so just encourage you as teachers, read books on, learn how to listen well, how to ask questions, and so on. Another suggestion: put your phone out of sight in a conversation. Okay. There's actually even something in a conversation, if you lay the phone out, it's still there, and it's got the possibility of beeping or buzzing or worse, okay, and interrupting. Do not interrupt a conversation to read a text or email. Keep mealtimes free from interruption from electronic messages. These are just suggestions. These are not rules. It's not saying you have to follow these things. I'm just trying to illustrate how we need to practice presence with people. Practice face-to-face communication with on-site colleagues. I don't know how it is with you, but in this animal that we live, this dinosaur that we live in, this maze that we live in here at Faith Builders, where you've gotten lost, okay, it's easy for us to email each other or whatever. And I personally, I live over in the East Wing, and I intentionally actually walk across and to talk to teachers over here or people over here in the West Wing just to have FaceTime. Some issues, it's just preferable to talk rather than doing that email thing. Don't write something in an email or a text that you would not say face-to-face. The more emotional content, emotion content of a communication, the stronger that is, the more necessary presence is. When using electronic communication, avoid clipped language. I don't have time to really talk about that. All I'm saying is that we use clipped language, we use it efficient language, and we we're not communicating humanness in this. I sometimes go back over an email just to check, how can I make this personable, that they can feel what I'm saying, not just hear words. Well, we've talked about a lot of things here. Rising to the challenge, I bring you back to the two greatest commands. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. I would like to sing stanza 3, the song that we have sung here now. I would be thine and serve thee forever, filled with thy spirit, lost in thy love. I would be thine and serve thee forever, filled with spirit, lost in thy love.
Lord, come with anointing, showers of grace and down from above. Open the wells of grace and salvation for the
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.